Okay, so thanks so much, Ayasoma, and to Samita and Buddhist Insights for hosting this, and to all of you who've come along. Very happy to be here, very happy to be here, and also a little bit nervous. I'm not quite sure how this is all going to work, so I hope that it will work okay, and looking forward to your feedback as well. What I want to do is I want to talk about one of my favorite topics, that is the end of the world. And my very dear friend, Venerable Akaliko, accuses me of being an apocalyphile, an apocalypsophile, and I don't even know how to say it, but anyway, he thinks that I'm in love with the apocalypse. But no, that's not the case. Actually, I would much rather go on my life and just be happy and not have to worry about these things. But unfortunately, that's not the hand that we have been dealt. And what I want to do is I want to talk about how we are to live in these times and how we are to try to face the reality of what's happening. Now, I just want to make a few kind of precursor statements just so that we're all sort of know what we're doing. I'm not here to debate climate change. I'm not here to talk about, you know, the science of it particularly. And I'm also not here to try to persuade anybody of anything. And I'm not here to try to get anybody to do anything, all right? So that's not the purpose of any of these kinds of things. So what I want to try to do is more of a reflective and philosophical reflection around things, to try to give a bit of space to our own sort of emotional and intellectual and spiritual responses to the challenges that we're facing, so that we can perhaps have a framework which is going to be more meaningful. Okay. So I've framed this around the four topics: life, love, joy, and acceptance. And I'm going to be looking at each of these themes as we go on. And one of the reasons for choosing these themes was because when talking about difficult subjects, and obviously we want to try to present it in a way that is not overly negative or unrealistically positive. We want to try to have a balanced approach. And one of the things that I personally have found frustrating is the dialogue around hope is hope, which sometimes called hope-ism. And I find that the dialogue around hope is often, to me, very condescending and quite naive, this idea that we all have to have hope. And I'll be honest, I don't have any hope. I gave up hope years ago. So just to stop just for one moment, we've had some complaints about the sound on YouTube. Do we have to do anything from a tech perspective on that? Usually if everybody's mics are muted on this end, then that should be reasonably good. But if the sound, anything needs to be done with that, Amina?
No, I think it's as it is.
All right. It is as it is. If anybody's listening on YouTube, sorry about the sound. Okay, so... like I was saying, I gave up on hope years ago, and I don't know, I'm doing all right. I mean, I'm not great. You know, I have my ups and downs, but, you know, it's all right. And we have this kind of thing that it's a very kind of, I find it's a very, very judgmental approach to things. And so one of the first things I want to say to everybody here is, it's okay. Like, whatever you're feeling, it's okay. If you're feeling sad, it's all right. If you're feeling anxious, it's okay. If you're afraid, yeah, you probably should be. If you're feeling depressed, if you're feeling worried, to me, these are all very normal things. They're very natural responses. Doesn't mean we're going to have to get stuck in those feelings. But we shouldn't feel like that there's something wrong with it and we have to hide for it and try to pretend that it's not there. It's okay, actually. And I get much more worried if I speak to somebody who doesn't have any of those feelings. That I find is somewhat disturbing. And if you're not worried, then you're either A, enlightened, or B, in denial. And statistically speaking, just gonna, likelihood is, there's a lot of people in denial in the world. Few maybe who are enlightened. So the first stage in this is just to say, look, it's all right. Whatever you're feeling, and we just accept those responses. I don't have any answers. And if there's one thing that I can bring to a dialogue around climate change and around all the problems that are besetting us, if there's one thing, it's that I think it's okay to admit that we don't really have the answers, because this is an unprecedented situation. Nobody knows the full scope of the problem. Nobody knows how to solve it. Nobody knows if we're going to get through it, or how we're going to get through it, or what's going to happen. It's all uncertain. So there's a starting point, at least. But I can say one thing. There's one thing that I know for certain, and one thing that everybody here shares in common, and that is, we're alive. We have made it this far. Everybody here, we've made it. We're here. Yeah? And that itself is pretty amazing. Oh, I should say, by the way, I should have mentioned this earlier, but can I just ask for everybody, if you can, switch your camera on, then that's really nice, because that means we can see each other and I can see the people that I'm talking to. I know not everybody wants to put their camera on, but if you can put your camera on, then I really appreciate it. And that's also how I know that you're alive, because otherwise you might not be, right? You might be just dialing in from the dead. That also can be a thing, yeah. So thank you for those doing that. So everybody here is alive. That's something, isn't it? Right? That's something. That's not an inconsiderable achievement. Right? There's a lot of people who haven't made it this far, but we have. Yeah? So far, we've managed to escape pandemic, we've managed to escape fires, we've managed to escape all of the other things all around us. So we're not doing too badly. Now, when we talk about what we call like an apocalypse or the end of the world and these kinds of things, what exactly do we mean? Like, what is that? What kind of thing are we talking about? Because, of course, the reality of birth, aging, and death, well, we all know that, right? We all know we're all going to die. We all know that none of this can last forever. Not even the whole universe can last forever. So in a sense, it becomes easy from a Buddhist or a spiritual point of view to just kind of dismiss it and to say, oh, we're not, you know, we're all going to die anyway. This is just a very, very Buddhist way of putting it. We're all going to die anyway, so who cares, right? Well, I care, because it doesn't have to be like this. And there's a lot of this the suffering that's going to be caused, and a lot of unnecessary suffering that's going to be caused. So what we have to do is we have to start to think in terms of what are the values and how we can build up values that are going to serve us in these times. The values that have served us up till now aren't going to keep working. Doesn't mean we throw everything out, but it means we have to reassess all the values that have mattered in our lives so far. Okay, I'll give you a bit of a simile. All right, so imagine we're in a car, and we are the kids in the back seat of the car. Mum and Dad are in the front seat of the car, driving. Dad's in the driver's seat. He's got his foot on the accelerator. This is a patriarchal car. And the car's going faster and faster. And the kids in the back seat are saying, hey, Mum and Dad, you realize you're driving towards this cliff. And they keep going. And Mum and Dad are arguing about something stupid. who paid for the restaurant last night, or who cleaned the bathroom, or something like that. And they get closer and closer, and the kids start to yell louder and louder, and they're screaming, "Dad, Dad, stop, 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 we're going to go over the cliff," and they get louder and louder. Now, what happens there? At a certain point, they're going to go over the cliff, and that's it. They're finished. Now, at what point in that journey should they give up hope? I mean, should they just always keep hope? What about when the car smashes into the rocks at the bottom and everyone's died in a blazing inferno? Is that time to give up hope yet? What about if they're like a meter above the ground? What if they're 10 meters above? What if they're just going over the cliff's edge? Is that too late? Is that too late for them to do anything? What if they're 1 meter away from the cliff's edge, or 10 meters away? Should they still have hope then? What if they're 100 meters away? If they're 100 meters away, surely they can break in time, right? They should be able to stop. If they're 10 meters away, well, maybe it depends on how fast the car is going and all of these things. So the point is that we never really know at what point the car is going to go over the cliff. But what we do know is that at some point, hope is not going to serve you anymore. There's going to be some point at which you're just finished. And what are you going to do then? What actually is left when hope is gone? This is, incidentally, I'm giving this as quite a gruesome simile, but I have to say this is actually something that I have personal experience of. And I have, in fact, personally driven a car off the edge of a cliff. And I have faced the certainty of my own imminent death as a result of my own stupidity. Yes. Many years ago, in northern New South Wales, in the worst country roads in New South Wales, yes, they were the days. Middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the night, heavy rain, driving along. Quite a large quantity of marijuana was involved. And then the road just wasn't there anymore. And we were just rolling down the cliff. And I still remember very clearly this kind of weird sense of this kind of dislocation, this weird sort of sense of on the one hand, like my brain was kind of split. On the one hand, part of me was like, I absolutely know that I'm going to die now. I had no doubt, you know. And then the other part was just like a sort of split off observer, was just kind of watching things. And it was like, it wasn't saying I'm not going to die, but it was just like the message wasn't really getting through. So hard to say. Obviously I was wrong because, well, here I am, didn't die. So that's a relief. But there's something about that moment where you come face to face with that reality of your own mortality. So if we come back to that family in that car, you know, the kids screaming, stop, stop, stop. Parents ignoring them, keeping on going. What do they have in common? I mean, at any point along that journey, they're all different. They're all having different emotions, different reactions, all of these things. But what is it they have in common? Well, what they have in common is they have life. They're all alive. And that is, to my mind, is what gives us the foundation for a set of values. Now, I have to admit that much as I would like to imagine that this idea was my idea, but unfortunately somebody beat me to it. And I don't know if you've heard, but 2,500 years ago in India, there was this monk called the Buddha, right? And he said a number of very interesting things, and I can strongly recommend that you read up about the Buddha and even read some of his sayings. And there's a little thing called Sutta Central you can go to find out those things. And he had some things to say about the end of the world. He actually had quite a few things to say about the end of the world. And one sutta that I'm thinking of in particular is a discourse called the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. And in the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta, it talks about how society falls apart. I don't want to go into too much detail about this. It's not a sutta discussion, but about how society and culture falls apart, driven by greed, driven by hate, driven by moral lack of morality, people falling apart. So this, I think, is the first thing to notice, is that when we look at what are the causes for these things, yes, we can look at there are causes in terms of technologies and there are causes in terms of politics and all of these kinds of things. But the heart of it, this is a moral failing of humanity, a moral failing of humanity that we could have made better choices. We just decided not to. And when we understand it as a moral failing of humanity, we're all a part of that because we all made our choices as well. And nice as it is to blame other people, we also have to accept that responsibility. So again, without going into too much detail as to the Chakravarti Sihanada story, I do really encourage you to recommend it if you haven't. But at the end of the day, everything completely falls apart and everybody's just attacking each other with knives, killing each other, and there's just butchery and mayhem. I mean, it's like this whole Mad Max scene. It's very dark, okay? And I know that Buddha is not known for his dark, grim and gritty stuff, but there's actually quite a lot in the suttas which is like that. And the Buddha didn't kind of linger on it. He didn't indulge in it, but he did acknowledge it. This is a reality. And everybody's gone, and the whole world is empty, and it's just dust. And the few remaining survivors are just hiding out until after hiding out, one man comes out. And then he looks out and he encounters another man who's also survived. And like this whole story is told like a parable, all right? And in a parable, we don't know anything about these people. We don't know their names. We don't know their backgrounds. We don't know who they were, why they survived, or what they did. None of that actually matters to the story. There's only one thing that matters, one brute fact that matters. They lived. They were still alive. And when they saw each other, they couldn't help themselves. They cried out, oh my goodness, somebody else is alive. Somebody else has survived. And they ran to each other and they hugged each other. And they were so full of joy because of that. They couldn't help it. There's another person who survived. And then they said to each other, my friend, it's so wonderful to see you. What are we to do? How are we to live now? And they said, what are we to do now is we are to let us make a rule by which to live so that this doesn't happen again. And what, let's take a moral priest. All of these things happen because of this collapse of morality, collapse of the ability of humans to live and to act because it was the right thing to do. Instead, we do things because it's productive or because it's efficient or because of whatever. But what's the right thing to do? And so they said, okay, let's make a rule. Let's make a precept. No killing. Panatipata veramani. Refrain from taking life. The first precept. The foundation of all morality and foundation of all Buddhist morality, not to kill any living creature. And that is the foundation for the reestablishment of society. From there, in that story, things gradually started to get better. People became healthier, they became more long-lived, they gradually rebuilt everything, and then at a long time in the future, there was an idealized society with a wheel-turning emperor, Sankar, and the Buddha Maitreya appeared. So all of this potential and this possibility, all of this amazing flourishing and abundance comes beginning from this one act of not to kill. So this is, from a Buddhist point of view, to me, this is the foundation of everything in our response to the situation that we're starting. To look at and to cherish and to value life and to ask ourselves, what does that mean? These things are so common, so taken for granted that we don't really interrogate it. We don't really look at it and ask ourselves what it means. And I want to come back. I want to contrast this, what I'm talking about, with the situation that we're in now and with the way that people talk about things now. See, like if we talk about climate change, we look at something like an IPCC report. The IPCC report lays out various pathways for the future, and the lowest pathway, I can't remember the names of the pathways now, but the lowest pathway leads to a future of a 1.5 degree rise. We're currently at about 1 degree or 1.1 degree. 1.5 degree rise is essentially just there to show that possible. It's not actually ever going to happen. It was more just as a demonstration thing. It's not, no one thinks we're actually going to stick to that. Then there's a 2 degree pathway and I think a 3 degree and 3.5 or something. So a few different pathways leading to a few different results, depending on the choices that we're making. Now this is all going to be revised in the next IPCC report, which is, or was supposed to be coming out next year. And this whole pathways thing has been treated in a much more sophisticated way. But I'm not here again, not talking about the details of the modeling. But what I want instead to do is to ask you to reflect on what are the choices that we're being presented with. We're being presented with a future that either 1.5 degree, that's not going to happen. 2 degree, 3 degree, rise. All of these are terrible. All of these are terrible futures. We're now at 1.1 degrees and we have pandemics. We have fires. We have the collapsing ice sheets. We have the Himalayas melting. We have the Amazon is on fire. We have the barrier reef is bleaching. All of these, we can't even list all of the horrible things that are happening now at 1 degree or 1.1 degree. And what will happen at 1.5 degree or 2 degree is going to be so much worse. And that's the good outcome. Right? 2 degrees is a great outcome at the moment. We're actually headed probably more for 3.5 degrees at the moment, if not more. And that's just by the end of the century. It doesn't stop at the end of the century. It keeps going. That's just a convenient marker. We just stop measuring it after that. It doesn't mean that the environment, it stops being falling apart then. All of these are terrible. Why is it that we've come to accept that we live in a world where we can only be presented from a range of terrible options? Seriously. Well, it's like we've shown up a restaurant to eat and they say, well, here are your options for tonight. You can have cow shit, you can have horse shit, you can have dog shit. I think I'll stick with the cow for now. That sounds like the least horrible. Why is it like that? Why are we in this situation? Why, when we're heading into the future, do we still decide to put our future into the hands of psychopaths? Seriously, why? Why do we let these people make decisions? Why can't we do it better? Think about what are the kinds of choices that we've made and how it is that we've got to be where we are. And we, as human beings, have created this incredible technological society. And the buildings around us are incredible. The computers we're using to do these things, the vehicles we travel in, all of these things are just amazing. All of these things we've done are incredible. Why is it that the cost of that is the earth? Why is it that we, with all of our effort and all of our energy and all of our ingenuity, can't create abundance? Do you see the problem here? Why didn't we use our technology to say, hey, let's make a better world? How would we be making a better world? And it's not as if this is just human nature. Absolutely. Human nature can do all kinds of different things. And, you know, just for myself, speaking here from Australia, and this land here is the land of the Burramuttigal people, the Eora nation, and people here were custodians of the land, and they looked after it and they nurtured it over thousands of years, and so that by the time the white people came here, the place was like a garden, and there was so much food going and fruit growing everywhere. The rivers are full of fish, trees are growing tall. We could choose to use all of our knowledge and our technology to create a paradise. We could. Think of how much beauty that we could make. Think of the beauty that humanity is capable of creating. That could be our option. These could be the choices that we're having in the future. We could be asking ourselves, do we want to have a paradise where there are another 20,000 elephants roaming on the fields of Africa, or would we prefer to have a paradise where there are greater forests growing or something like that? These are the choices that we could be having. We could be asking ourselves the questions of what kind of abundance and vitality and prosperity do we want to choose in the future? Because we could create that world if we wanted to, if we really valued life. But we've made different choices. Yeah? So to me, as a Buddhist and as a Buddhist monk, then this precept about not taking life, this is the number one precept. And this is, has to be the foundation for our values for the future. And if we want to make a future which is going to be abundant and flourishing for everyone and for all living creatures, then we have to start from that. And so if we ask ourselves the question, is the world going to end? And everybody answers, you know, this kind of very kind of shallow online dialogue about it, which I find it very kind of annoying. And some people saying, blah, 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 we have to have hope. And other people are saying, blah, 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 no, we don't have hope. And blah, 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 we're all doomed and all of this. Actually, it's all of that discussion is a load of nonsense. I mean, the reality is that it's just probabilities, right? I mean, there's a certain probability that we might make an end of things. We know that, right? We might make an end of things tonight. Right? Forget about 100 years in the future, right? We created nuclear weapons. Don't forget that. And we gave them into the hands of Trump and Putin, both of whom could end life on Earth tonight if they wanted to. And there's not no chance of that happening. There's some chance of that happening. And so the chance that we, humanity, will end life on Earth cannot be zero. It's got to be something. Is civilization going to last? Is humanity going to last? Is it 10% chance? Is it 20%? Is it 50? Is it 80% chance? Is it 90% chance? Who cares? Why are we asking ourselves? Why are we allowing ourselves to have that conversation? Why is it any percentage at all? How is it acceptable that we as human beings will create the potential to end our lives, the lives of our children, our civilizations. How is that even remotely acceptable, even if it's the percentage is just 0.001%? That's already too much. We're asking the wrong questions. And the questions we need to be asking are, how are we going to create a life of abundance and flourishing in the future? How can we turn this around so that what really matters and what really values is at the forefront of everything that we do? So this is my first, if you like, life hack for you all this evening. And so this is the idea. The point about this life hack is that during this whole time, right now, next year, in the future, we're going to go through all of these different feelings, all of these different emotions, all of these different states. We're going to be forget about it. We're going to be depressed. We're going to be anxious. All of these things are going to happen. But as long as we're still here, we are still alive, and we can still cherish our own life and cherish the lives of others. That gives us a foundation for how to act, and it gives us a guide for the kinds of choices that we're going to make. And we can continually ask this as a way of extending and expanding the scope of the first precept. So rather than just the first precept, of course, in a narrow sense, am I killing anything? But in a broader sense, does this choice lead to more life in the creation and abundance of life? Eating meat versus vegetarianism, buying new clothes rather than buying second-hand clothes, traveling on journeys, building houses and renovating them. All of the choices that we make in our lives, these all have an impact on life and how life flourishes on Earth. So we can try to make better changes, better choices, and we can reject the false dichotomies that we're being fed, that somehow it's natural and normal that we are being given a bunch of shit and asked to choose which one we like. All right, so that's my talk for you this evening about life hacks for the end of the world on life. And it's now about 41, so it's about 40 minutes. And I'd like to open up for questions or feedback or comments. And particularly I'd be interested to hear people's like comments and feelings and responses and how where they're at and so on. Or if you have any like specific questions, then that's also, of course, welcome as well. So we'll begin with a question by Aya Soma, because I know that she'll never be lost for words. Is that right, Aya?
You're putting me in the spot, Pompton. I was reflecting on your words, the flavorful menu. So I need a few moments to digest.
Good, yeah, I was thinking that, yeah.
And but I am, my mind is, I'll get there. I'll have a question for you very soon, but perhaps someone else here has other questions before me.
Yeah. So I mean, just to sort of by way of reflection, you know, I like my trip last year. So most of these folks that we're seeing here from Europe, so this is where I was. So then when I flew out from New York, but when we were in New York, of course, we had I'm just trying to think what was the particular climate change calamity. Oh, that's right. There we were fleeing the California wildfires, so that happened, and then arrived in New York, and that's right. And then there was the snap cold, so then we were there, and the gas was off. So that was cold showers in the sub-zero temperatures in New York. So thanks for that. That was a great experience. And and that's right. We were in Rockaway, which had been flooded in Hurricane Sandy, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. And actually, we just moved to New Jersey, and my first comment was like, oh, it's great that there are no hurricanes in New Jersey. And there was just a hurricane a few weeks ago. And apparently these days now it's twice a year that there's several devastations actually in the area where we are. So yeah. It's getting worse and worse pretty much everywhere. There's no space, in that shape or form.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got a question from YouTube. Oh, so Kelly wants to speak. So Kelly, I believe you can unmute yourself. You've got your hand up.
Did it work?
Yep, that's it. We can hear you.
Okay. Hi, Wante. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate your ability to be so very real about all this. And the blend for me of the resources that come from the Dhamma. And that come from having, you know, some worldly vehicles like Extinction Rebellion to join with others, you know, is to, it makes a way to live with what reality is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for continuing to speak as you are. Yeah. Thank you.
That's really kind, and that really means a lot, Kelly, because like, When I'm doing these things and I'm trying to teach these things, I don't know what I'm doing, and I just have to try to figure it out. And we actually talked about this years ago, a part of a group here in Sydney called Australian Religious Response to Climate Change. And one of the big things that we all had, you know, and this we shared right across the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, the Hindus, everybody. And we had this, we all shared this problem that these are matters of great moral urgency that we need to present to people. But at the same time, you know, how do we do that? People are used to hearing us talk in a certain way about certain kinds of things. And I could sit here and give my thousandth talk about metta meditation, and everybody would be quite happy to hear that, right? That would be great. But these are things we need to talk about, and how do we do it? We just have to try it and see, you know? So, I really appreciate the fact that people sort of give me the opportunity to do it. Okay. Any hands up from the audience? No. Okay. So one from YouTube. So a question from YouTube. Talking about being environmentally friendly, what do you think of the movement in some circles on permaculture in Australia? So look, I don't know too much about it. I'm familiar with the general philosophy on permaculture. And I think that's great, but I'm not really sort of up on the movement as such. There was, incidentally, little known fact about me was that I briefly flirted with the idea of becoming an organic farmer before I became a monk, and I lived and worked on a organic farm in Penang for a few months shortly before I became a monk. So it is something I've been interested in for a long time, and permaculture seems like it's good, and I really encourage people to do that. And maybe Isoma has some words to say, because I know that you were growing some vegetables in the Rockaway. Do you have a place to do that in the current monastery?
Yes, thank you, Bante. Well, actually, we did. We had a little attempt at growing things this spring, as many did in the United States, but actually it was not as successful as in the Rockaways due to a lot of different conditions, like a lot of wildlife and the hurricane and whatnot. But we're actually in the process of designing together with a nice volunteer who was finishing a permaculture design course. Our dream is to transform the 2.5 acres of lawn out at the Cloud Monastery into a food forest. So it's definitely something that is both useful. It's food for humans and the entire wildlife here. Now that we moved to the suburbs, it's incredible the amount of wastefulness that there is and the amount of pesticides that go into creating these artificially maintained lawns, and it's pervasive. It has taken over the entire natural habitat, which means that all the wildlife is starved. So it's our dream is to do it.
Sorry to interrupt, Aya, but just what do you mean by the wildlife there? What kinds of things?
From the deer all the way to the rabbits, to the bees, to any type of insects. They're starved, and when they actually find anything to eat, so pollens, etc., they also ingest a lot of chemicals, so they're being exterminated, which is, of course, it also affects humans in terms of our food supplies and the planet itself. So there's high pollution of all the water sources here because everybody uses artificial fertilizers that then cause algae overgrowth. So our, approach is to lead by example and offer our space to turn it into something that is more of a natural environment, with the idea that our neighbors here will copy and paste, hopefully. So creating a new trend. So yeah, if you have more grow food, not lawns, is a great motto that we definitely stand for here.
Yeah, good. We actually have a community garden here in Harris Park in Sydney, not far, just a couple of blocks away from where we are. And we were planning to actually get our community to go down and do some help out there. But then, of course, all of this happened, and then that didn't happen. So it's still on the to-do list. Yeah. But I do think that one of the things that's really important, just like it's really important to do practical things. You know, we've also talked about doing maybe like a sewing circle or something like that. And just we need some, you know, ordinary, basic practical skills. Yeah. Okay. So another question from YouTube. So somebody said, one of my daughters tells me she doesn't want to have children because she doesn't want to bring them into the world as it appears to be heading. It's so sad, isn't it? Yeah? What would you say to her? I would say, yeah, I'd say that's really sad, but it's very understandable. And I would say to her that she's not alone, and that this is something that, you know, young women and couples are thinking about. Should she do it or should she not? This is not something that I could say. But I think it's really important to, when people, especially when young women are feeling this way and are having these thoughts, it's really important to take them seriously, and that they shouldn't be dismissed, and they shouldn't be, we shouldn't just kind of marginalize it. It's actually a very serious thing. And again, to me, is like a point of reflection of how did we do this? How did we create a world where I gave live streaming is on. So some of the people here were at my retreat in Belgium last year over the New Year period. And at that time, the bushfires in Australia were in their full guardian. On this particular issue. And that was a lady called Gemma Carey. And these were articles on the Guardian newspaper, and you can search for them and find the articles, that she was in Canberra when the bushfires were at their height. And she was about to have a baby. And she talked about this, and she talked about how she too didn't hold out any hope for the future. And she's a sociologist. She's a university lecturer. And she's saying that even though she doesn't think that her child would have any future, then she wanted to share what time she could with her. And to me, there was something quite, like in the article, she wasn't trying to defend it or wasn't trying to argue for this point of view, but just trying to share her own perspective on it. And I think to me, there was something quite beautiful in that. And it comes back again to that question of life, which I've been coming back to in this thing, that a life is valuable, even if it's short, even if it's not the best life we can have, then it's still something. So I don't think that there's a right or a wrong answer, and I don't think that we should be preaching to young women about the choices that they're making. Sorry, you've got any noise coming across there? Sounds like there's an air raid going on. No? Okay, now we're finished. All right, very good. Excellent. So, yeah, we shouldn't be preaching to people, and we should be accepting of the choices that they're making. So for the person who asked that question, it's heartbreaking, I know, and I know it's heartbreaking for your daughter, but she just needs your love and support, that's all, and your trust that she will make the right decision. And I think that one of the things that we, as the older people, have to do is we have to acknowledge that we stuffed up big time. I'm sorry, but we really just did. And we didn't mean to, but God damn it, we did. And here we are. So we're just like really sorry. And if you don't think that our answers are going to be any good for you, you're probably right. So just ignore us. Okay. So I was posting another question from YouTube here. What's the most important points of action you would envisage in a wise response to a bizarre situation with the threat of so many nuclear weapons? Probably looking at some best organized activist groups. I remember an interesting, quite recent podcast about with Sam Harris. I'm not entirely sure, but I definitely think that the nuclear weapons problem is one that is absolutely just brushed under the carpet, and we just kind of get used to it, and we really, really, really shouldn't. Those of you who've been watching the news in the last day or two would have seen that North Korea were just parading some of the world's largest ICBMs, which they've just unveiled. So after we were told very confidently a couple of years ago that that's all solved and the North Korea problem is now done. Yeah, well, no, actually, that's not happened. It is absolutely immoral to be creating nuclear weapons. And it's immoral for countless reasons, but one of the reasons it's immoral is that you can never know who's going to get your hands on the bloody things. And if you think that you can make systems that's going to guarantee that they're only going to be used safely, I mean, the idea that you can think that they can be used safely is just so immoral in the first place. And then there does not exist a governmental system where you can guarantee that those will not be put into the hands of psychopaths. And that's what's happened today. And it's really dangerous. And, of course, as climate change proceeds, then the danger of them being used goes up and up and up. So definitely is related to everything we're talking about, and definitely something that I would strongly suggest, especially for anyone who here is from listening in from the States, that this is something that you should be raising with your representatives, and you should be lobbying your representatives to basically eliminate or reduce nuclear weapons as much as possible. And especially, if in the event of a democratic government in the next term, then please take advantage of that and make sure that this issue doesn't go just under the weather. I know that there were a lot of disarmament talks under Obama, and that this needs to proceed and needs to be taken really, really seriously. So I don't have any specifics because I haven't been involved in that area, but there is a friend of mine who comes to the talks in Sydney, and he works full time in this field. It's one of the few people who actually works full time in the field of nuclear disarmament. And we used to joke that he's one of the few people in the world whose job required them to be look forward to a day when the world would last long enough to be destroyed by climate change. Okay. Another question from YouTube. Bhante, thanks for sharing the Dhamma. Could you please talk about walking the tightrope between the corporate world and Dhamma? Right. Sometimes I feel that I'm too drowned into corporate culture, and then I come back to study some Dhamma and be able to save myself. Very, very powerful choice of phrasing there, right? To be drowned. And this is actually, reminiscent of a lot of the phrasing that we hear the Buddha using for talking about the defilements, that the defilements would be, one would be overwhelmed with them, that one would be like drowning in the flood, like the ogres, and or be stuck in the marsh, and these kinds of ways of thinking, ways of talking about it, and to feel that way about the corporate world that you're stuck in, it's hard, right? It's hard. I don't have any, you know, I'm a monk, right? So I'm very lucky that I can leave all of that stuff behind, and then I can get my bowl and I can walk down the street and people will put some food in my bowl, and that's pretty good. And I understand that not everybody can do that. So you've got to earn your money somehow. So sometimes we just have to do the best we can. But the only thing that I would say is, you know, obviously you try to do your best. Obviously you try to live a moral life at your work, and you try to live the best culture that you can. But also remember that there are a lot of different places, a lot of different opportunities. Keep your eye out. And there are good people making right livelihood in all kinds of different industries. And some, I'm sure that there is somewhere where your skills and your presence are going to be valuable for somebody. So keep your eye out, even if you can't find something right now. And if you feel that, you know, I don't know what your circumstances are, so I'm not sure if you're, you know, what your work is or how that's going. But if you can look for an opportunity to find meaning in contributing in a positive way, then don't neglect the fact that your ethics and your integrity and your love are invaluable for somebody somewhere. And in somebody's work, somebody's company, then those qualities that you can bring, regardless of the professional things, but your personal qualities, your humanity, is something that can grow and enhance somebody's work or somebody's job somewhere. Okay, Theresia. Has made writing a comment here. I just feel like I'm a little done with philosophizing about how we could do better. People who should care more just don't. I understand how you feel. Are there people in this group that want to start a revolution? Yes. That won't be remembered as one that won't start another global war, but will change hearts of more people worldwide on a profound level. We are capable of doing so. Sign me up, Theresia. I'm up with that. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, thank you for that feedback. And look, I know that this is, you know, to me, you know, I want to make this as kind of space where people can share that and share their feelings. You know, we're not going to solve all the problems today, but we just to express that. Okay, so another one from Ayasoma. So this is from YouTube, posted by Ayasoma. Thank you, Aya. Should I accept my despair? If not, how to challenge it? Thank you for that question. Despair is okay. Despair is not the end of the road, all right? Despair is a feeling, and despair can be a very powerful part of a spiritual journey. Despair is never nice. It's not fun, okay? But it can be a hopeful sign, in the sense that despair is the precursor for a fundamental shift in values, for what we call an existential crisis. And existential crises are good, and you should have more of them, okay? And what an existential crisis is like if you feel like the rug has been pulled out from underneath you, like your sense of purpose and sense of values is just all up in the air. And it's accompanied by all of these kind of emotions, which can be despair, anxiety, but not necessarily negative emotions. It can also be accompanied by euphoria, by like a sense of, I can do whatever I want and all of these kinds of things. And so it's easy to mistake an existential crisis for an emotional one. Not easy to tell the difference always, right? But the difference is that the root of an existential crisis is meaning. It's searching for, it's looking for a new meaning, for a deeper meaning and deeper set of values. And so this is why it takes some courage and it takes some guts. So if you're experiencing despair, then, you know, it's hard. I know. And I want you to know, so whoever asked that question, I want you to know that I feel you, that I care for you, that you're not alone, and that there are so many people around who are going through something similar. It's okay. It's understandable. It won't last forever. It's impermanent. Despair is impermanent. It can't last forever. So don't hold on to it. Don't attach to it. But look into it and to see how out of this, how is a new set of values and a new way of living going to grow? And this is one of the concerns that I have, is that if we're too successful in managing our emotions, right, to keeping things on track, of course, it's good to do that. We need to do that. We need to control our emotions to keep them on track and all of those things. Absolutely. Right? But if we're too good at it, then we can miss out on the more profound transformations and questioning that can come. All right. Shannon, I believe what we do and say will lead by example is the best way to influence others instead of preaching. I agree completely. Every little thing that we can do and show others, spreading love and kindness, makes a difference. Thank you so much, Shannon, and I agree completely with that. And I'm hoping that that the people who are here and the people who are on this chat and this session together will understand that. We as spiritual practitioners, I believe that we as spiritual practitioners have a special role to play in these times. And I don't mean like a particular practical role. I mean a role in a sense as witnesses to the truth and as witnesses to the human condition. And again, this is quite separate from what we might do in terms of activism and so on. Here I'm talking not about your activism or anything like that. I'm just talking about how you are as a person, what kind of values we share as a person. And so we can take that role of being an example and being a guide and being a light for others. So thank you for that, Sharon. John, and I'm just trying to see which John this is. Anyway, John says, hi Bhante, I like to think of the five precepts in an expansive way as you talk about today. I wanted to share Thich Nhat Hanh's ideas on this. Right, so John from New York. Hey, how's it going, John? Yeah. Sorry, we had a few Johns in the last chat I was on as well, so yeah. Yes, Thich Nhat Hanh also expanded this. And one of the things about what Thich Nhat Hanh's doing is he's actually restoring a lot of the meaning of these five precepts that are found in the suttas. And of course, you know, when the Buddha was teaching about morality in the suttas, he wasn't just talking about not killing, but was also talked about, a much more expansive approach to it. And one of the lines in the description of this precept, it says, one dwells with a heart full of compassion for all living creatures. So this is something that goes well beyond just not killing. Yeah? And so this precept of not killing, to me, is something which is a constant call of how we can live better, how we can live to value and to cherish all life more fully and more abundantly and more totally. Okay, Ayasoma. His hand up.
Yes, Bhante, I actually finally have a question. I was wondering if you could recommend an appropriate response. So when dealing with climate change deniers or people sharing conspiracy theories, that is all the rage these days, and we often go through like the whole moral relativism and it's just my opinions, don't get attached to views and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, what do you do, Aya?
Huh, what do I do? Yeah. Well, I have questions to senior monks as my original teacher.
Oh, come on. That's just the patriarchy. You can do better than that.
Well, by monks, I mean by senior monks, we use monk as gender neutral here at MC.
Okay. Fair enough. So is that it? That's all you got?
Well, yes, I want to know from you, because I don't know if I have an appropriate response. I definitely have a response, but I don't think it's the appropriate one.
Tell me what it is. It's the starting point. Go on.
Well, what I try to do is fully listen to the person sharing their experience or their views, trying to keep an open mind. So not going there with the idea that I know the answers to everything, because actually I'm not a scientist. I'm not a professional myself. So there are certain things that I seem to have an awareness of, that I see in my, you know, in my experience, like kind of like what we're talking about in terms of permaculture. So all the insects dying, the environment dying around us, or this sort of, you know, kind of trauma. So whenever I am faced or presented with those thoughts, I try to understand why, or ask questions to see where and how that person, why they're holding that view to begin with. What is their definition of truth? And then through that exploration, also see where I am holding the experience, you know, what do I define as truth? And from there, trying to establish a dialogue. But most often than not, it can be very challenging, because there is a sort of barrier of not even venturing into any sort of openness to having that dialogue to begin with. So when someone places such a big wall, like only this is true, anything else is wrong, then, you know, eventually I will just stop engaging with that person. But I don't know if that is the appropriate response, or if there is a more skillful way to approach it.
Yeah, well, thanks. You that's certainly mentioned a lot of the issues there. I mean, I think obviously it depends a lot on context, right? So, I mean, if it's somebody who is your in your family, your immediate family, then that's different. And somebody you have to be with, then you know, for some people we have an unconditional relationship with, and somehow we have to work that out. And you know, a lot of people do it by avoidance, as was one of the methods recommended in the Sabbasava Sutta. And that can happen. And as you said, like reaching out to people. I mean, one of the things there is that, yes, reaching out to people and trying to communicate them, obviously that's the best way, right? What you outlined there is the best way. Try to listen to what their view is. Try to bring them on board. Try to find common ground and all of those kinds of things. That's the best way of doing it. The problem, however, is that while you're doing that, you're not doing all of the other things that you could be doing, starting with doing some nice meditation, or even like sweeping up the vihara or whatever it might be, right? We're not doing all of these other things. And it can be a tremendous drain of time and emotional energy to actually give all of this time for not much in return, because at the end of the day, we can end up actually just in the same state as before. So I think that, I don't think that there's a black and white on this, but I think that people should feel that it's okay to just not engage with people who are like that, right? It's all right to say, okay, look, I just don't want to talk with you about it. Yeah. And that's very much the approach, especially that we take online, and on our forum on Discourse. We banned climate change deniers. And you know, that was something that I requested for the moderators, simply because it's just exhausting and it's just a waste of time. Now, one of the problems is that online discourse is of necessity much shallower and harder to get to the matters of real substance. And this is why I think that this is one of the major problems that's happened, is we've shifted our social dialogue onto social media, and we haven't grappled with the fact that the level of discourse there is just crap. It's just so bad. And if you're in a room with somebody and talking with them and actually taking the time and the effort to gradually, and often over a period maybe of weeks or months or years, getting to know them, appreciating their values, and then reaching out to them, that's just a completely different kind of thing. So I think especially online, that my personal recommendation would be, don't try to engage with these things online. Just block them, or just don't even bother. Of course, it's difficult to know because there's always grey areas, but I think there's part of it. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that so much of this discourse is driven by bad faith, especially with the bad faith kind of assumption of the two sides. You know, we have to present two sides of things. And no, there aren't two sides to it, actually. And we have to have the confidence to say that. If you're interested, I wrote a little fairy story about that recently, which is on our website, on the Lokanta Vihara website. It's about fairy castles. And so it's just a short little story, and you are invited to read that if you want to read a little fairy story. And it's basically a story about that breakdown in communication. And I think one of the things which is really sad about it, right? One of the things that's really sad is that it's nice to live in a world full of weirdos. And right? And it's lovely to be able to think that, oh, these people with crazy ideas and the wacky things, and it's actually really fun and it's engaging and so on. And if it wasn't so toxic and so dangerous, it would actually, like in the old days, conspiracy theories used to be fun, right? But now they've taken all the fun out of it. So, and we end up, you know, I find myself, you end up in a situation where you're constantly having to say, well, no, that's not actually what the fact is. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to do that. It's boring. But the stakes are too big. Anyway, so look, if there's one thing that you can remember out of what I just said, it's just this, that it's okay to not engage. It's all right. Don't feel guilty about it. If you want to make that choice, make that choice. Okay, so I'll answer these other couple of questions that we've got on here from Michael and from Flavio, and then we'll just finish up because we've got, I think, enough time for this evening. So from Michael, if the law of karma is based on intention, would it involve bad karma to take, say, on a long-distance flight, for lack of a better everyday life example? A flight passenger probably does not intend to harm the climate at all, but, so to speak, hazards the consequences. Yeah, how does the law of karma know about climatology? Yes, well, exactly. So the issue here, and this actually calls back to something which I mentioned in passing in the talk, calls back to the problem that our morality is not really adequate to address the issues. I don't mean to say that the teaching on karma or something is wrong, but I'm just trying to say that the way that we've been thinking about it is not designed to cope with the world that we find ourselves in. And, you know, if we look back at traditional Buddhist discourse and people would talk about this precept on not killing, well, most people would concentrate and say, well, don't squash the cockroaches and don't go fishing or something like that. And so, you know, we keep it on very kind of simple examples. But, yeah, don't do those things. But that's not the thing that really matters. We're killing whole species, we're destroying whole rainforests, we're wiping out the whole communities of fish in the ocean, all of these terrible things that we're doing. Surely that matters. And of course, the indirect link. So one of the things to understand here is that the fact that the links are indirect is not an accident. Okay? So you, to give that example of going on a flight, there's an indirect link between going on a flight and destroying the environment. And we can't say that bird died because I was on the plane. Well, maybe we can if the bird got sucked into the jet engines. But we can't say that this frog in this rainforest died because I was with my flight. right? It's an indirect link. That's the point. That's why the system was built. It was built in order to separate cause from consequence so that people could act in ways where they didn't see the result. And I have a very obvious example of this is factory farming, where, you know, in the past, if you killed an animal to eat it, you killed it and you saw the blood and the guts and you saw that this is a creature whose life came to an end. But now we're so separated from that. We don't even know what it's like. Most people don't even know what a factory farm is like. So the system has been built in order to make that separation. And so one of the things that that implies is that our response to it has to be systemic. It can't be based on just individual choices. We have to change the system. And so the law of karma is, just to come back to the original question, is based on intention. But that intention also has a positive intention as well as a negative intention. So on the negative intention would be the intention to kill, right? And so we can say, and someone's taking a flight, then they don't have that intention to kill. But the positive intention is the inverse of that, the intention to promote the flourishing of life. And that intention present, right? Is that how we're living? Are the choices that we're making choices that are in line with the intention to promote the flourishing of all life? Or is it just because I want to get away with it? Right? I can get away with it on the precepts and say, well, I'm not deliberately killing. Right? Yeah, you can get away with it because that's not the kind of thing that the precepts are for, right? The precepts are just a kind of checklist of some basic moral rules. So to create positive karma is to not think of morality in terms of what can I get away with, but to think of it in terms of what can I do? What can I create? How can I be better? How can I live a better life? Okay, so Flavio, Dibande, thank you for your talk and for these fresh perspectives. No worries. I'm very happy to be able to share that with you. I'm a little bit confused by how much I can do, how much you should do. I know exactly what you mean. I too am very confused by this and I don't know. And I always feel every day that I should be doing more. And I think I should be giving up more. And then I look around and think, what am I going to give up? I don't know. But anyway, it seems to me like in your simile with the car that a lot of things are out of our control. Yes. Right. A lot of things are out of our control, but that's also the system. Right. And this is why we can't see these things independent of the system. The purpose of the system is to take things out of your control and to tell you that you're in control, to tell you that you're empowered, to tell you that every voice makes a difference, to tell you that you can make a change. And this is the things we've been fed so often in our democratic societies. But actually, we end up being powerless. And what's strange about it in our modern times is how much we get this discourse of powerlessness even from the leaders, even from the heads of state and the ministers. These people are giving us this doctrine of powerlessness. I mean, I've heard this directly from the Prime Minister of Australia, directly from the Environment Minister of Australia. They're telling me that they don't have the power, that they can't make enough change. Right? And so we've been told our whole lives that we can have this power, and yet who has that power? No one, apparently. Yeah? This is how the system is built. Yeah. The last thing that remains to do while grabbing close to the edge of the cliff seems to be cultivate mental virtue, but certainly not a bad thing to do. What do you think about that? How can we cultivate it in our daily life? Sure, you know, coming to the edge, be the best person you can. If you're in that car with your family, say to them all, I love you. If you're the one who's in the driver's seat with your foot on the accelerator, say, oh, look, I'm really sorry, guys. I should have paid attention. When you were yelling back there, I should have noticed, okay? I acknowledge that now. And that's at least we can do, right? So from a Buddhist point of view, again, the idea that things are out of control should be a familiar one, right? This is the teaching on not self. Right? We can't control and we can't fix everything. So what can we do? Well, again, come back to we can choose what kind of person we want to be. We can choose how we want to live our life. At least we have control over that. And if we have control over that, then if we die in that state, then I think we're not doing too badly. So at least we've got control over that. Okay, we should probably finish up there. And I really want to thank everybody for joining in the conversation. I want to thank especially once more Samita and Buddhist Insights for hosting this, for Atresia and Amina for the help, and special best wishes and blessings for Vimala. Everyone, please, Vimala has been ill and has been in hospital, so hopefully everyone, can we do some metta for her? We will be back again the same time next week, right? Same time next week, is that correct, Tresia?
Yes, exactly. It would be next week the same time.
Okay, very good.
If the world didn't come to an end yet.
I was going to say exactly the same thing, right? So if we survive till next week, then we will be back again for the talk. And so my talk for next week will be on love. And so what I'd like maybe for this week, and I think Ayasama's point, you know, she made a good point that you know, it takes a while to digest these things. And a lot of these are ideas and things that I've been contemplating and reflecting on for many years now. So what I'd like to ask you to do is to, you know, I would actually really love to be able to do this with you in person, and to spend some time to be able to reflect and meditate on it together. But for this week, can I ask you all to just try to spend some time in your meditation or in your reflection, just to sort of think about some of the things that we've been talking about, and then to just, as we go on for these series of workshops, then I'd like to also hear more from you. So this first workshop is mostly me talking, but I'd like to hear more from you as we go on. Okay. Very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Aya, and all of the venerables and all of the good people who are here, thank you so much for all your time and your attention. And I wish you all the best. And I wish may you be happy and may you always flourish in the Dhamma. Sadhu, sadhu.